the land. That is where our roots are. There is the basis of our physical life. The farther we get away from the land, the greater our insecurity. From the land comes everything that supports life. The land is there waiting to honor all the labor we are willing to invest in it. The land is able to tide us across any dislocation of economic conditions. No unemployment insurance can be compared to an alliance between man and a plot of land. This was Henry Ford's advice, written during the heights of the Great Depression, written in 1932. Now listen, and listen good. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to answer very honestly. Do you feel free at this very moment? Are you satisfied with your current situation? Why or why not? And when was the last time you felt totally unplugged, on your own, or at peace? Now, I don't know where you may be listening from, but I bet you felt the same resignation as I did when you saw the title, 5 Acres in Independence, particularly the independence part, am I right? No matter your satisfaction with your current situation and how self-sufficient you may already be, I know this road towards sustainability and independence never ends. There's always something new to learn and improve upon. So I bet you'll find at least a gem or two of some good old grandpa knowledge in M.G. Cain's book, 5 Acres and Independence. Bom dia, buenos dias. Welcome to Eco Village Library. I'm your host, Christopher Kinney, and I'm here to summarize for you great works being produced within the world of sustainable living, resiliency, eco-village community living, you name it. My background is in sustainable development engineering, and most of my work and learning years have been spent with small farming communities throughout the Americas. Now, I've finally taken the time to fully digest this classic that's been with me over the years. I've taken a few dabs in here and there, but the truth is this book intimidated me. It's like one of those reads where you know your old man is just gonna talk some sense into you. You don't always want to hear it at the moment, but you'll always end up appreciating it later on. That's kind of how I felt with M.G. Cain's and this book, which was published, mind you, many, many decades ago during the heights of the Great Depression. This was before the advent of Frankenstein agriculture, so it's been an eye-opening journey for me to spend some time in America's long-forgotten agricultural ways. So with that being said, you'll notice the language and style of the book to be quite different. Instead of getting you inspired to leave it all behind and move out to the country, the author says it how it really is. Frankly, moving out to the land and making a living is tough and downright difficult, especially for the one who is moving away from the city with no experience. In one of the first few sentences of the book, he warns, "Not everybody succeeds. There are certainly tried and true ways to fail." But don't let that discourage you, though. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. When looking for land, you need to have a plan, a dream. Jumping into whatever to wing it is a costly way to gain experience. It's best to hit the ground running. And since some might find city life quite comfy, why leave?
Well, I'll tell you why you should leave, boy. You can't be living your whole life as a cliff dweller. Your expectation of life, boy, is shortened by tainted air, restricted sunshine, and lack of exercise, to say nothing of exposure to disease. City existence is ultimately non-productive. It deals with what has been produced elsewhere.
But I'm sure that M.G. Cain's did not sound anything like that. Quite the contrary. He seemed like a pretty nice fella to me. And it's true what he says, though, you know, because anything could shake things up, and shake things up quite dramatically. You know, my lovely Luzmar, she's from Venezuela, and her family still lives in the major cities. And as you may know or not know, now they are having an economic collapse, complete economic collapse. And they've just now started to lose power, leaving everyone without water. Toilets are getting backed up. 10-year-olds are ransacking the food stores. But in the country, the effects are less extreme and there aren't as much people suffering and dying due to failure of basic necessities being disrupted. So this is why claiming your freedom outside of the system will leave behind blessings for you, your loved ones, and anyone else within your circle. So let's make the jump, shall we? Where do you feel it makes the most sense to hunker down for you? Where do you feel drawn to? Maybe better, where is the most affordable? And if you're low on cash, there's no need to despair because there's always a way. Always. We'll get into this one a lot in future episodes. So maybe you got a place already in mind. What questions are necessary to ask from the get-go? Well, let's start to look around. How are the neighbors? The schools? Where's the closest doctor, veterinarian? How are the roads during all the seasons? How much would this property charge you in taxes? How and where can your future markets be marketed? It's impossible to take too much caution when deciding a spot for your future farm, homestead, garden, or whatever it is you have in mind. Now, mind you, that the subtitle of this book we're analyzing is A Handbook for Small Farm Management. So just remember that in this context, we talk about independence and self-sufficiency from the standpoint of small subsistence farming. The author reminds us again, before plunging into the juicy details of sustainable living, that one's success depends primarily upon the individual and or community who undertakes it. Not everybody who starts will succeed. On the other hand, those who have the following personal qualification, no matter what your previous calling or location may have been, stand a good chance of succeeding. That is, a natural liking and curiosity for the calling, which is the most important asset because it will assure willingness and patience to work and be painstaking to details, to be open-minded and alert to detect irregularities so as to adapt and apply new knowledge. And this is what separates the anchovies from the tuna. The nature of making a living and a business from the land is characterized by an abundance of small but essential details which demand very close observation and careful interaction. The author, Mr. Keynes, here tells us that in few businesses and ways of living are cleanliness, orderliness, and timeliness of such much importance, for without them, weeds, pests, and diseases thrive, and the good life fails to appear. And learn it all. Allow yourself to soak the abundance of knowledge like a sponge left on the outside table during a rainy day. Learn all the hows, whys, and whens. Remember, become a keen observer and a logical thinker. Think as you act. You'll develop shortcuts and efficiencies. This will ultimately benefit everyone as you will inevitably teach others what really works for you. And I learned this the hard way when I started to dive into this world of, into agricultural pursuits. And I started in my early days when I moved to the Dominican Republic. I was brought down to help manage the organic farm that they were starting up. And so I was taken under the wings of some of the Dominican farmers and just doing what they were doing and following their instruction. And I would get into losing myself in the work, kind of just like wandering off, thinking about other things as, my body's going through the task of whatever it was. And at this time I was taking out trees, weeds, brushes and everything. And then all of a sudden the guy came over and he had just a shocked look on his face. And he asked me, "What'd you do?" I was like, "What are you talking about? you know, I'm doing clearing the bush like you instructed me, you know. And he's like, no, you just took out the whole roseberry tree that was there for years. And I was like, oh, fuck. It just stabbed me in the heart of like knowing how careless and not thinking as you acting could really just mess things up if you're not careful. And after that, I've trained myself to be present in every moment. So it was kind of a slap in the face of, you know, catching me when I was not being present. And I meant to say a rosemary bush, not a rosemary tree. But anyway, this experience was absolutely necessary for me. As the author has put it, without practice and real-time experience, no book, not even this one, can make you competent. But that doesn't make books any more useless. They do inform you by presenting ideas, methods, practices, tables, illustrations, etc. And this storage of information can certainly build up and serve you nicely when you may least expect it. But until you have tested them by actual practice, you cannot know how practical they really are. It's all about action. The ideal, according to the author, is abundant observation and the translation of this into proper decision making. An example is like taking habitual strolls around the property or the land, wherever you are, and filling your mind with all the habits and patterns and behaviors of all the helpful and harmful animals, birds, insects during all the seasons, all the temperatures, all the variations. You'll see all plant stages of growth for yourself. You'll understand this from the sprouting of the seed through all the stages of stem, leaf, flower, fruit, and seed development. You'll know and interpret the behaviors of these plants and all the animals under various conditions. Of heat and cold and heat and cold and once again and sunshine and shade and sunshine and shade and once again and dry and wetness and more dryness and more wetness, fair and foul weather, rich and poor feeding, and so on and so on and so on. And ultimately you realize 30 years later that you've become a master of your craft. That all of this gives you, the thinking observer, mastery over your business and ultimately brings you in intimate and deep communion with your environment and in tune with the infinite. Now, back to choosing our land. Where to locate is totally a personal question, but it is wise to choose a climate of which you are already familiar. This will certainly avoid all the mistakes due to the nuances of a particular region. Additionally, you'll need to have your dream already drafted in your mind, such as the type of agriculture you wish to follow, whether it's dairy, fruit growing, poultry, market gardening, etc. And once you have the location set, it's very important to then analyze the area available for productive use when looking to buy. Otherwise, you just have a tax liability hanging over your head. The secrets here, though, lie within the soil. The physical condition of the soil should receive first attention, particularly from the beginner with small capital or scrap for cash. More than likely, you'll inherit soils that's been raked and beaten around before you got there, or in other words, mismanaged. It pays to know what classes of crops have been grown on the land during the years and how it was been fertilized and treated and what, you know, chemicals have been sprayed on and et cetera. The good news is that it only takes several years to fix such damage. However, be aware that there are some soils which are naturally of poor physical condition. So in this case, it would be like trying to train a chicken to whistle. In the book, the author says, putting a soil in prime condition for planting is a fine art which can be fully learned only through long experience in handling the specific type of land involved. It's kind of synonymous to the soils of our own spirits, which makes me remember of the serenity prayer that goes, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Just as within our own lives and the results we produce or the fruits that we bear, you can take this concept to the land in question and know the land deeply by looking at what it bears. Perhaps the most useful indicator is the characterization of weed growth. Knowing the weed is important, but the secret is revealed by the character of its growth. Lush, sturdy, very dark green, and leafy grass usually indicate that the plants are well fed, especially with nitrogenous compounds. But if their growth is pale, sickly colored, scrawny, and just barely making it through, then the land is certainly not rich at all. You gotta know your weeds. A good weed to Google is called sheep sorrel. They are small plants with a spearhead-shaped leaf with a tart taste. If you see this in abundance, especially if they are puny, then the land is acidic and infertile. This will show you that it'll be unsuitable for many crops, but this could easily be corrected by adding lime. And, you know, there is also others that the author mentions, such as oxeye daisy, wild carrot, and mullein. Google these. Know them. These in abundance will show that the land has been badly mismanaged, that their abundance indicates lack of humus and fertility. And, you know, this book is filled with all these, like, golden hidden secrets of knowledge, of very detailed descriptions and various scenarios. So from here on out, you know, I'll go dabbing into each particular area of which you will generally most likely encounter yourself when moving out to the land and starting your farm business. So what's characteristic about this book that is that it instructs to start with the objections first, then move on to the advantages. So, you know, it's very, very useful information apart from the weeds, is also to judge the character of your land by looking at its trees. You know, it's a whole other level, if you will. The book lays out that the beech, sugar maple, hickory, black walnut, and white oak trees of large size and vigor indicate rich land. White pine, scrub oak, and scrawny trees of most species are typical of poor land. Willows, poplars, and alder and elder bushes suggest too much water and probable need of drainage. Speaking of which, how deep do our soils go? One way to find out can be to stick an auger in the ground or by observing the trees of the area, once again. For the purposes of this book, we'll be talking in relation to the climate types typical within North America. But if you live elsewhere, just put on the lens of your place's climatic type and follow along. So when figuring out the depth of the soil, or in other words, how close is the water table or the groundwater to the surface, know which trees have shallow roots. Because if you see them, that would be a key indicator that the water is close to the surface. In North America, examples of such trees are red and silver maples, whereas big, healthy black walnut and hickory trees will tell you the exact opposite. I would rather much see deep-rooted trees, since that will tell me drainage is good. Having shallow soil is a liability. It's cold and wet in the spring as the water table approaches the height of surface, and it rapidly dries out and bakes under the summer sun. So, as I already nudged at, having good drainage on your site is key, and by looking at the soils, you'll immediately find yourself looking at the drainage. So, spit fire to yourself a round of questions. 1. Does the land need drainage, or is it already draining? 2. Where? Where are the wettest spots? When the land is dry, you'll be able to answer this question by noting the presence of bulrushes, sedges, and other water-loving plants. Brooks and springs indicate very good drainage. Flow and movement equals life force. You know, when I was working on Molokai in Hawaii, they had this, I don't know if you ever seen those biodynamic water flowers that direct the flow of water so that it circles and takes a serpentine flow-like pattern as it is circulated through whatever system it's part of. Anyway, the owner of this ranch I was working on was a big fan and wanted that for this particular region of the ranch. It was quite interesting to dive into Rudolf Steiner, who is the founder of biodynamic agriculture, and to know the reasons why. But we'll do that another time. So now we know where we're moving to, what kind of land we're going to be dealing with, and how water moves in and out and all around. Now It's time to dip in our paintbrush and begin the divine task of encouraging the greatest potential of the land and simultaneously of ourselves. Knowing where the sun rises and sets and shines during every hour of every day will guide us as we begin to create our home. Now let's say the economy just collapsed and you just want to get seeds in the ground and start growing away. Well, for simplicity, you decide to make rows of crops. You just want to get it in there. But make the key observation, at least, by seeing that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. So it'll make the most sense to create your rows running north to south so as to guarantee even distribution of light. Much involved in this part of the process, especially if you want to design as intelligently as possible. I will certainly review books of this step alone in the future, but for now, just look up, you know, something like permaculture design and permit yourself to get sucked into whatever rabbit hole you find. Trust me, I've done it and I highly recommend it. Now, you got your rows set up and now we must think about what are the most essential factors of production. Well, first and foremost, we need water. Any type of irrigation increases and improves crop production of any kind. The author states that irrigation will be found desirable at some time in practically every season. Although you must be cautious, excessive irrigation early on while the plants develop will cause the development of shallow root systems. So it's better to deep soak a couple times a week versus frequently irrigating daily, you know. And he also mentions mulching around your crops with straw and humus and manure. All of this will greatly increase your yields and the quality of your crops. You know, 2 to 4 inches is adequate. And you could estimate, you know, 10 to 15 tons of straw per acre or about 500 pounds per 2,000 square feet. And the labor of putting all this mulch is largely balanced by the future reduced labor and weed control. You know, and you got to make sure those weeds don't go to seed. As they say, 1 year of seeding equals 7 years of weeding. So I haven't mentioned much about whether you should rent or buy your land. So I'll do that right now. What would make the most sense to you? The book lays out key advantages of both. But we'll start with renting, you know, renting farm property. And the biggest advantage, it says, is that no capital is needed. And that's probably the biggest advantage in my mind. There's no need to lay down big bucks for neither the land, buildings, fences, repairs, and improvements, etc. So instead, you can spend whatever money you have on what the author calls loose properties, such as machines and tools and animals, portable tiny homes, all which can move along with you. It's also especially advantageous to rent property if you want to plant only annuals, which all may be grown and sold within the same year. This could apply to poultry too, if you so please to go down that route as well. Ultimately, renting land could be a great way to start out and to see whether or not pursuing farming and homesteading is really for you. And although the author would argue that one growing season is not the fairest test, you know, you got to go through the winter. The winter is the true test when all you got to eat or sell are eggs and milk. The only way to meet the rigors of cold weather must be met with fortitude. Then make your decision. So all in renting land is, all in all, it's very valuable for the opportunity to gain experience before making any kind of permanent investment and before you lock in your commitment. Buying land, on the other hand, is a whole different animal because you are locking in your commitment and you're putting more on the table. The author talked about his experience consulting with those looking for farmland property, of which he said he recommended against twice as many properties as he did in favor. His reasoning for advising against acquiring certain properties were mostly due to, you know, inadequate water supplies, being too stony or too swampy, stuff like that. Other crucial items to secure are those within the legal realm, such as having a clear title, meaning there is no question as to who owns or controls the property. You know, you got to know, you know, you'll be the property owner, but do you own the water rights and the mineral rights? Because you could easily, you know, think you own the land, but then all of a sudden, you know, some mining company has the legal right to go on your property and start drilling. So you got to make, you got to do your due diligence to answer all these questions. And now you got to think about taxes. You know, are there any unpaid taxes on the property? You know, what about a transfer of insurance and all that? But don't worry, I'm just talking about, yeah, I'm done. Even I'm tensing about talking about these things because it's just part of the process, at least here in the United States. But you could, you know, seek out a good attorney and ask legal advice about this process, like searching title and drawing up the necessary papers. And, you know, once you get started, it's not a big of a deal. You know, you just got to educate yourself. Education is key. You know what to look out for. Know, be disciplined in your research. And after reading this section, I myself have come to resonate with the idea of buying, you know, but on a very small piece of property and eventually renting adjacent properties as you start to grow. So maybe even buy these properties if you manage to grow a successful business, you know, like as I mentioned earlier with Joel Salatin, you know, it's important to start small and have your operation become modular, you know, incrementally grow as your business grows or your operation grows. So if you proceed with this strategy, it'll be important to study the whole situation in advance before making any moves. Now, I was very surprised to read what the author had to say about land as not being the best security. He assures that it is not. According to him, it all depends on your business ability. That is, if you're starting out as a borrower or with very low capital. If this is you, it's so important to have every I dotted and T crossed with your finances. No lie, I felt pretty intimidated by one of the quotes from the book about farming as it read, "Farming is largely commercial, not self-sufficient. The farmer is dependent upon the sale of commodities to pay his debts and his taxes and to buy many necessities. It is true that the farmer generally has food, but he also has difficulty in meeting debts and taxes. Often the threat of possible loss of his farm through foreclosure hangs over him. He sees himself unable to provide a reasonable comfort he would like his family to have. But again, if you start out small with money you have and slowly build and expand over time, not only will you be gaining key experience with what you can manage, but you won't carry this existential threat of being kicked off the property for not paying up what is owed. So a good habit to always have is to keep track of everything. Mr. Keynes advises, keeping records is the most effective way by which to determine the truth about oneself and one's business, and its less economical and less productive methods, practices, crops, and livestock. And along the same lines, here's a quote from Harvey Wiley in The Lure of the Land. And it goes, "Farming is a business which requires the highest business talent. It is a profession which requires the best technical skill. No other profession requires such a variety of learning, such an insight into nature, such skill of a technical kind in order to be successful as the profession of farming." This book further dives into finances and borrowing on credit and so on. I'm just going to skip this part. If you're dying to know more about this, though, let me know. I'll review some books on the subject if you really want to dive into this together. Otherwise, I'll go ahead and get into the more interesting details of living off the land and claiming your independence. Straight up, you can't get a good operation going or achieve any kind of independence without a reliable water supply. Again, no water equals no life. So what's your source going to be? A well, spring water? Mr. Keynes here is a big fan of rainwater. He says it's so superior to most well and spring water, and is such a money saver that every farm and home should have a supply. It requires no softener, uses less soap, and is more pleasant to work with. And I'm, you know, when he mentions this, he mentioned for domestic use. And we'll get more into what kind of water, water supply, water quality is needed for irrigation and other different applications. And a lot of times with groundwater or spring water, you just have a lot of undesirables that you'll have to manage to filter out before every use for, say, drinking and cleaning and such. And back in the day, from when he wrote the book, he says the most common storage for rainwater is by an underground masonry cistern made from cinder block and concrete. Nowadays, plastic is one of the most common options. And water storage is very interesting when you consider the materials involved. If you have some rejections with these materials, you know, what are some alternatives you can think of? Now, I'm just now finishing this book all about water storage, so I'll be dedicating a whole episode to this one later. Now, for sizing the cistern to service all practical household purposes, there are three factors to keep in mind. One, water requirements of you, your family, and animals, and whoever else. Two, amount and frequency of rains in the area. And three, area of the roof to collect the rainwater. And then from this, you can make your calculations and so on. On the subject of water, a particular fascination of mine is the hydraulic ram. It's by far the cheapest do-it-yourself pump with no energy requirements other than the water itself that flows through it. It's essentially a device by which the momentum of the incoming water flowing through it forces a small part of itself to a higher level than it originally came from. So it's like, you know, one, some examples I've personally seen have been utilizing an air chamber within a plastic PVC where you have the water come in and the pressure of it going against the air pocket will just thrust it out the other end. So you could have a water coming down like, let's say 10 feet from a spring source. You could pump that up like 30 feet going using this simple device. It's really cool. And, you know, in the book, Mr. Keynes, he mentions this as well. And, you know, on a general note, the fall from the supply to the ram must be at least 2 feet and the minimum flow to be 1 gallon per minute. But the fall necessary depends on the volume of water needed and the height to be pumped. Next, we got to think about what to do with all our poop, all our doo-doo. And there are many ways to do this. I've seen it all, believe me. Very commonly in the country, septic tanks are used to treat this waste from flush toilets primarily. However, more and more I'm seeing an ever-increasing popularity of composting toilets. It's a bit to get used to, but I love them. In short, you poop in a regular toilet, but usually, you know, to a chamber that you perhaps design yourself. So that ideally you can open up the hatch and have compost ready for your trees. However, please size it right because I found myself one time on a farm in Portugal where they didn't expect to have so many guests in so little time. And so the whole thing, the whole chamber from their composting toilet filled up before it was able to, you know, cook itself into ready-made compost. So it overflowed. We had to scoop it all out. Fresh, wet, gooey poop. It was the worst. Don't fall into this mistake. It was terrible. Anyway, the book doesn't mention any of this because composting toilets weren't around during the 30s, or that I know of at least. So instead, people relied on septic tanks, and they still do.
The book says, ideally, when properly built and not abused, one should never have to clean a tank in his lifetime. And Mr. Keynes here goes into vivid detail on how to design it right using concrete, which was the common method of construction of the times. And I got to say, you know, reading through this book, you're constantly reminded of the difference of the times, you know, almost a century of difference. And everything he mentions in regards to piping refers to vitrified clay. Nowadays, you never see them used anymore since they're so brittle. They break so easily. You know, you see mostly PVC a lot, depending on the context and what you're using it for. And so now we got water and a place for our waste. Next up is to secure our food supply. This leads us again to the soil and particularly in its water holding capabilities first. No other factor is as important to plant growth as water. Mr. Keynes tells us that studies of plant growth have proved that each pound of dry matter in a mature crop has required from, 200 and 900 pounds of water to develop. Hence, an adequate supply of water is vital for plant development. And remember this, it's not enough to have free-flowing water on hand because the main form of water that plants use to live and grow is called capillary water. Now, capillary water is, it's the thin film of water that surrounds the soil particles and is the main source of water in plant growth and is the most effective form for dissolving and holding soluble plant nutrients. You may increase the supply of capillary water in the soil by irrigation, adding humus, and improving drainage, or in other words, avoiding stagnant water at all costs. The most feasible way to increase water supply in the majority of soils is to maintain the crub-like structure that favors the ascent of capillary water from below. Now, frequent overhead watering is not such a good idea when providing water. Why? It encourages the roots to develop near the surface where they are almost certain to be injured by summer heat, especially if watering is neglected for a few days during some of the dry weather. It's better to water once a week instead of a little every day, so that way the roots could develop deeply and take good hold of the ground. So there's so many angles from which to construct the most life-giving environment to grow our food. As I just mentioned, make sure you're getting water flowing in and out and all about. Having good drainage is so important. Otherwise, the land stays cold and acid and not very conducive to the type of life that will support your sustainability efforts. Good drainage benefits everybody by making the land more easily worked, encouraging higher percentage of seed germination, and by making the soil more favorable to root development because now there is more organic matter available for plants to feed upon. From an engineering perspective, I thought the book did a fantastic job at explaining the technicalities of installing proper drainage. But remember, as with anything else, there's about 100 ways to skin a cat. There is no such thing as, an all-be-all one-shot method. So provided that water has its pathways unblocked and can flow freely, let's now focus on irrigation. Even where the normal annual precipitation rate is ample enough for the production of vegetable crops, you still won't go wrong with irrigation. Look at it as a form of crop insurance, especially nowadays with very unpredictable climate variations and such. And the chief sources of water for irrigation can be from, ponds, reservoirs, artesian wells, and municipal water supplies. The size of the plants and the amount of foliage or its leaf area all influence the desired amount of water to supply. Shallow-rooted crops such as radishes and onions usually require more frequent applications of water than do tomatoes or carrots. But remember, don't get in the habit of light and frequent watering. And there are no hard and fast rules by which to decide when to irrigate. The best guide is examination of your plants and soil moisture. I thought it very interesting to be reading this book before the era of plastics. Nowadays, I don't ever see any irrigation system that doesn't use any plastic. If you're the exception, please let me know because I want to learn more of the alternatives. In this book, he shows irrigating by way of a canvas hose like you see on fire trucks today. So I wonder if this could be a potential opportunity for a modern-day alternative pipe material. While we're on the subject, I remember having a conversation with a retired structural engineer about, this very topic, material alternatives for pipes and water distribution. And it was very interesting to note that there's, he mentioned glass. I'm like, glass, but isn't that pretty energy intensive? Maybe, but I'm not so much of an expert on the subject, but from what he was telling me, glass is essentially a heated form of sand. So if you have an abundant supply of sand and let's say some sort of electricity or an abundant supply of heat, then you could easily make glass pipes. But that's all I know. that's the extent of my knowledge. But it's a very interesting you know, door, see if it's there's a deeper rabbit hole in that one. But now back to the book. I'm assuming that, you know, you're listening to this from a region of the world that experiences at least a little bit of frost every year. So Mr. Kane says, there are many ways to control the development and therefore the hardiness of our plants in several ways. For instance, during spring, we could avoid overfeeding our young plants with stimulant fertilizers such as manure, and also avoid giving them access to water. These two together in excess tend to make sappy growth, which is easily killed by frost. So on the other hand, by keeping the plants cool, almost cold, will harden them off and increase the hardiness of even tender plants. Now you can see that even plants need a little bit of toughness. It keeps us strong before any winter season. Now, it's also interesting to note any nearby features that may influence the temperature you and your plants feel. For instance, if you are near a pond, the water will keep the air cold in spring, but will keep it warmer longer during the fall, thus postponing when the first frost arrives. Remember that cold air is heavier than warm air and flows like water from high to low ground and settles in hollows or pockets, unless it can drain to even lower levels or be driven out by the wind. Frosts are much more likely to occur when the air is still under the clear sky than when there is wind or clouds. Your plant starts to go out when the temperature continues below freezing for several hours, especially when bright sunshine or quickly warming air strikes them early in the morning. Now, looking beyond the food we're growing from the ground, we're confronted with the very tempting choices of livestock we can have. For the context of a small piece of land, Mr. Keynes recommends against having a cow. He says a cow will require a minimum of an acre of pasture to support her, even though she will get much of the waste from your vegetables and other crops. In addition to this, more or less area will be needed to supply her with fodder, even when they are bought. On a 10-acre farm, 1 acre of forage means 10% of the gross area, and 1 of 5 acres would be 20%. These percentages, according to Mr. Keynes, are far too high when considering the usual cow for her milk and maneuver. Now, I know they're also quite risky to handle. You know, when I was, again, in the Dominican Republic, there were quite a bit of cow that we were managing, and half of them were bulls, or a good portion of them. And, you know, one afternoon, we were moving them around, but then they were quite aggressive, and one of the guys I was working with was provoking one of them, but he started to chase me. He just started going at it. And I was, oh my God. And I ran up this tree. And then I realized, you know, my coworker was telling me, take off your shirt. Because then I realized, you know, the shirt I was wearing was red, and it was red on sunset. But man, I saw my whole childhood flash before my eyes and learned, okay, this is something serious. And I also met a guy in Costa Rica too, that he was handling a bull, and the horn just punctured through his armpit and out of his shoulder. And he was showing me the scar and it was just, holy crap. I never, not growing up on a farm, you know, it's, you don't really hear about any of this stuff, but this is not to like bash on cows or anything, just to shed light on the risk. Well, particularly when it comes to handling bulls or male cows. I've also had plenty of other pleasant experiences with cows, milking cows, particularly in Colombia. And that was great. I mean, they could be very docile, very fun. But for the context of the small piece of land, he says it's, you know, there's just better livestock, which we will mention. But before we do that, he also says sheep too also have no place in the small farm. And it was hard to hear this one because I love working with sheep. I worked with them in few locations. Most that sticks out to me is my time in Argentina and Portugal. But in Portugal in particular, there was a very serious sheep farm we were on. They had quite a bit. I think there was about maybe 50 plus sheep, I would imagine. And they were fantastic. I loved working with them. But he says a milking goat is where it's at, especially when you don't have much grassland, because the goat will thrive where a sheep would starve. and its milk is highly nutritious and very good for cheese making. You know, I remember making fantastic, they call it flan, in Argentina with this goat farm, and we would make the, it's just a dessert, Latin American dessert from the milk of the goat, and man, oh boy, it was delicious. But they, you know, he says, you know, as you know, we're comparing sheeps to goats for the small acre property or for a small piece of land, it's more efficient or better to have a goat. Not bashing down on sheep, of course. It's just, you know, if you have more area, then it would be make more sense. But ultimately, it's a personal choice. At the end of the day, you want sheep or you want cow, you get sheep or cow. He's just speaking from the context of his experience and his recommendations. But his ultimate recommendation for livestock is the pig. That is, that it's the one domestic animal that best fits the conditions of the small farm, because he requires smaller area than any other, needing only a pen and some range and shade and a good wallowing place. And this, by the way, can also be utilized to seal up any ponds you may build, because it seals the clay, and with their waste, it forms a natural impermeable layer. So this could be very advantageous when thinking about not using any plastic liner to hold the water in your pond. This is a fantastic option. And I first heard about this too, particularly from Joel Salatin, which I've heard him mention doing that when he builds his ponds, at least some of them. But it's very interesting, you know, using nature to achieve what you want to achieve without having to purchase from the outside, and thus staying dependent on the system. You know, you're still going to be dependent some way or another. No man, no land is an independent island, but it lessens that to an extent, thus getting yourself more independence. And he continues saying that the pig is, you know, he demands no unreasonable time or attention. He is the most wonderful of all domestic animals as a converter of waste and worthless fruit and vegetables, even weeds, into profitable meat. Hence his name, the mortgage lifter. But are you prepared to use it as meat? That's the question. To be a vegetarian farm, you will ultimately, you know, it will ultimately be a personal choice that you will have to consciously make. And it's quite disturbing when you slaughter a pig or when you process a pig. You know, I was invited to join this yearly ritual ceremony in Taiwan with this indigenous village. It was a spearfishing indigenous village in Taiwan, and they do a pig sacrifice or pig meal every year for that. And so they were teaching the kids, you know, how to kill the pig, how to process the pig. So, you know, I went with them to grab the pig, and I already knew that the pig knew. You know, we went to the corral or whatever you want to, his where he was staying, and you just feel it, you know. And he would squeal, and we would have to put the rope around his neck, and you know, bring him on the pickup truck, and he just fights as strong as he can, and it's you have to get used to it if you're going to go down that route. But they took it on the pickup truck, and then they showed it in front of all the kids. You know, youngest one there watching, being like 5 years old. And then, you know, they turned it over, and then they punctured it in the throat, and it's, you could hear it squealing. Oh, just be prepared. That's what the reality would be like, you know, if you're going to do this. And was, you know, during this instance, they didn't kill it completely in that instance. So it plopped back up, started running around, and blood was splattering everywhere, and all the kids were screaming. So Mr. Keynes mentions our favorite domestic animals with very interesting applicable wisdom. You know, his quote goes, "I believe no farm is complete without a dog, though. Not necessarily a purebred animal, but one well-trained in obedience. I also strongly sponsor the cat, because the cat prevents mouse and rat trouble, but the cat needs protection when outdoors. And, you know, good feeding will remove the need of the cat killing birds. So training them while young and whipping him across the face and head with a dead bird he has just caught will usually cure him unless the habit has been allowed to form. You know, and he spits these kinds of like bits of wisdom throughout the whole entire book. So this is just an example of one, and I love it. And we're also forgetting a very important recommendation from the author as well. And I don't know if you could already guess what animal is missing. The most common animal, perhaps, of farming is chickens. But start small, because it's best to start with a few hens and give them good care and a comfortable living arrangement from the get-go. You know, take the time to observe them closely. Know them. The investment work needed as compared to the advantages of keeping chickens are very minimal. But be careful not to build up too quickly up to a commercial scale before solidifying the fundamentals. You know, old Mr. Keynes instructs to have cleanliness throughout. This means clean chicks, clean incubators, clean ground, clean litter, clean feed, clean water, clean management. In other words, cleanliness throughout. So let your slogan be health sticks to clean chicks. Lastly, he mentions beekeeping, which is a whole world of study in and of itself that demands incredible knowledge, patience, and attention to details. And one should not go in for commercial beekeeping until after you have served your apprenticeship with one colony, then with others developed from it. For he says, in no other branch of agriculture is it so important to learn to creep before you try to walk. Next on, we begin to expand and develop our land and its self-sufficient operation with a never-ending list of possibilities. Let me tell you, don't let the small size of this book fool you. It's so jam-packed full of golden gems that are still relevant today. What's crazy is that I barely covered a half of the book's material. Later on, Mr. Keynes gives his plethora of knowledge about greenhouses, cold frames, hotbeds, soil management, manures, old school tools, orchards, fruit trees, nursery management, crops to avoid and choose, seeds and seedlings, transplanting, storage of fruits, vegetables, you know, and there's even whole chapters about strawberries and grapes, you know, about particular areas which he finds most advantageous or most effective to begin with. You know, all in all, though, to be most successful, I like to remember this quote that has apparently echoed throughout the ages, which goes, "Don't hurry and don't worry, but keep moving and make every stroke count, especially the last." Well, that's it for this episode. This one took quite a bit of time to soak in and wrap up, but the journey has been fruitful nonetheless. So what in particular about moving out to the land and living by your own means most appeals to you? Please share your comments and give your answer and let me know what you think. And to wrap this up, I'll leave you with a quote from one of the earlier presidents of the United States, Calvin Coolidge. He says, "There is no safer place of existence than the moderate-sized farm. It is not often practical to employ a large amount of machinery in a large area of land and attempting to turn agriculture into manufacture of some single great stable. But the family that makes the farm an old-fashioned home with diversified crop, fruits, and domestic animals sufficient to meet the household needs will still find agriculture one of the most satisfying forms of existence."